This conference will now be recorded.
It's Monday, March 9th, 2015. This is the Reading Odyssey's 2,500 year anniversary of the birth of comedy. Reading group, we are discussing tonight Aristophanes' Lysistrata. Before we begin with that discussion, I did want to actually remind everyone and even ask you to take a moment right now on the phone and register for the webinar that we have coming up on Monday, May 11th with Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor of The New Yorker, and Paul Cartledge, professor, Cambridge University. And we'll be talking about the birth of comedy in Athens 2,500 years ago. And we had a great pre-discussion. But before I say more, if you go to comedy2500.eventbrite.com, you can register right now while we're on the phone. And we certainly want all of you on that call if possible. It's at 7 o'clock Eastern time on that fortuitous day of May, Monday, May 11th. And we have tracked down, that is the exact 2,500 year anniversary.
Snake oil sales.
And if you register tonight, you will get a free prize. Free prize inside. What is that prize, you ask? Well, it is the gratification, the sense of gratification that you are a part of history. All right, cool. So I'm just going to pause there for a moment. Comedy2500.eventbrite.com. Register now. And if you register, Martin Short will actually give you a call at home and tell you a joke. If not, his friend Steve Martin will. All right. So I get a little alert whenever someone registers, guys. So I'm waiting now. I need
at
least.
I have my computer.
Okay.
Yeah, I need my computer.
2500@eventbrite.com and
comedy2500.eventbrite.com.
Can you send a link out?
I could if I knew how to work this technology stuff. There it is. There's the email address. Comedy2500. There we go. Link to register now. Yay! All right. Okay, I just sent it out.
Okay, so I don't think the veteran reader donation thing is working right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do we have one for the actual webinar?
Yeah, we do, and it's charging me $2.02, and I think you wanted more than that, which I was willing to pay. I'm just saying.
Well, first of all, I didn't realize we were charging for the webinar itself. That's my bad. I didn't review that. And it's okay that we are, obviously.
I thought it should be free.
Yeah, it says free. Kendall, you might be registering.
Oh, no, I'm registering for the wrong thing. You're right.
You're registering for the reading group.
Yeah, never mind.
Sorry about that. Okay. My message to the reading group is awaiting moderator approval. It must have. I wasn't sure.
Okay. You're the moderator now. Prove yourself.
I know, it must have my collaborative game link, so let me try that one more time. https://. Sorry, guys. Didn't mean to take up so much of our time. But somebody did register for the webinar. Yay, we got a registration. Let's see who it was who made it through the gauntlet. It was Frank Rensler. Thank you.
Because I have an iPad and a phone, so I can do two things.
You're ambidextrous. Okay. All right. So let's. I sent the link. Oh, we got another one come through. Holy moly, they're just piling in now, one after the other. So thanks, guys. I appreciate that. We're gonna have a fun night. And that was Zach. Thank you, Zachary, for doing that. Okay. All right, so let's. I'd like to have the conversation tonight in three parts, if possible. I would like to begin with our favorite passages, as we often do. And then I'd like to have a discussion about what we think Aristophanes may have been trying to do with the play, and certainly for, you know, put ourselves in the mindset of the ancient Greek audience and try to understand the play from their perspective. And then let's have a discussion about what the play may mean to us today, which, of course, could have absolutely nothing to do with Aristophanes. Who cares about him? He's dead anyway. All right. Okay. All right. So let's begin with favorite passages. So I'd like to call on each person and find out what in this play was a one or more favorite passages of yours. Would anyone like to start us off?
I'd like to start us off.
Kendall.
So those of you who know me know that I'm a knitter and a spinner and all of that. So Lysistrata's explanation of how women would deal with the political problems, like dealing with a tangled skein of wool, I absolutely adored.
All right, give us the page and location number if you don't mind.
So it's just after line 565. I'm reading the recommended version on my iPad.
Okay. Okay. Cool. And read the text one more time so we can all appreciate it. Say it again.
The magistrate says that the international situation at the moment is in hopeless confusion. How do you propose to unravel it? And she says it's very easy. She explains, consider how we deal with a tangled skein of wool. We take it like this, and with the help of our spindles, we pull it gently, now in this direction, now in that, and it all unravels. That's how we'll unravel this war, if you'll let us. Unpicking it by sending diplomatic missions, now in this direction, now in that. And she goes on to compare the whole city, running the whole city on the model of how you prepare and spin wool.
Right.
Imagine the citizen body as raw fleece. You start by putting it in a bath and washing out the dung, then lay it on a bed, beat out the villains with a stick, and pick out the birds. You deal with the cliques who knot themselves together to get chosen for public office. You must card those out and pick off their heads. I won't go on, but I mean, it's a beautiful analogy, and I just adored that. It made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, great. Good. Yeah, that was a great section.
Yeah, but
all right.
Kendall, in your expert opinion, does it work? Can you unravel and clean up a tangled web of yarn?
Yes, you can. Yes, okay. You absolutely can. You know, it starts out being smelly and messy and miserable, and you know, with work and importantly patience, it turns into something beautiful.
All right, Bill, since you spoke up, what's your favorite?
Oh, well, just a minute. You know, for me, it was more like fragments.
Yeah,
kind of. There are a lot of one-liners in this one.
Like, we'll never more eat celery.
Random. You know, and a lot of them were rude one-liners, like or just kind of interesting things that you wouldn't expect in a serious play today, like. You know, I swear not to use the lioness on a cheese grater position.
Yeah, that one was really funny. That worked too. I had to look up the footnote on that.
Yeah, the footnote on that one, right?
The
not trying to know. The one who asked later on, will we lie on top from now on then?
Yeah.
There were just so many good sexual one-liners. But yeah. I also thought, you know, some of the political stuff was actually interesting. And maybe not even, I mean, besides whatever points he was trying to make, just some of the political dynamics. Like, I think it's line 630. No, it can't be line 630. I'm sorry, I don't have. I'm trying to figure out where the location is. Where the men are saying this is, it is line 630, where the men are first learning of it, and they say this is an anti-democratic plot. And shall we yield to tyrants? No, we'll not. You know, the interesting thing was from the point of view of, you know, a member of the assembly. And if you're not really, you know, fully understanding what the women are trying to accomplish, you know, it would look like very much anti-democratic, right? They're trying to overthrow the will of the people who've been governing Athens, who, you know, is the male citizenry. So, you know, there are some interesting political dynamics going on here. But yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. Cool. All right. What about you, Scott?
I had a most favorite and a least favorite.
Interesting.
My most favorite's right at, I don't have it in front of me, but it's right at line 500, when the magistrate says, you know, by Demeter, it's against nature. And this is a joke that Aristophanes makes a bunch of places, and I just have to remember that one. The men are constantly calling on female deities or saying that they'll defend a female deity or whatever at the same time that they're trying to, you know, put the women back in their place.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was doing it on purpose. I think it's pretty clever. The one I didn't like is at like, it's right around line 1025, when one of the women plucks a bug out of a man's eye. And I was just thinking how the men had all gotten smoke in their eyes earlier on from their logs. And that a good modern comedy writer would have found some way to tie back to that and make the joke out of that. You know, just, and I remember thinking, you know, this is really the beginning of comedy. And, you know, we've had 2,500 years of practice. And, you know, we probably craft them a little bit more, you know, more neatly nowadays than Aristophanes could.
So you're criticizing Aristophanes for missing a moment there, an opportunity? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, I'm thinking to myself, you know, after I read Liz Estrada, I watched a Seinfeld episode, and then I watched an episode of Modern Family, and I thought, you know, there are a lot more jokes coming at a much faster clip in these TV shows than you get in Greek comedy.
All right, Scott. Jeez, man. Come on.
You're bringing me down, man.
You're bringing me down. Of course, in his defense, as I understand it, there are a lot more jokes than even the footnotes are cluing us in on. But I'll leave that. Okay. Interesting. All right. Who's next? Who wants to jump in? Andre?
This is Nancy.
Okay, go ahead, Nancy.
And this ties in a little bit with what Kendall was pointing out, and I actually hadn't focused on the paragraph before as much, but now I will. But the line that I like is around line 590, and immediately before that is a lengthy paragraph where Lysistrata talks about, imagine the citizen body is a raw fleece. You start by putting the bath, washing out the dung, you know, all of that. And then the magistrate, after this lengthy description of the treatment of the wolf, that burrs, balls of wool, all this nonsense. What right have you women to talk like this? What have you ever done for the war effort? And Lysistrata says, done, curse you. We've contributed to it twice over and more. For one thing,
yes,
giving you sons and had them sent off to fight. And that's such a profound statement, and one that still resonates and still is used. And it's used just in so many contexts of, you know, if it's mothers against drunk driving, or like just what it means to be a mother and send your children off to these things, but in this case, you know, off to war, and what kind of a contribution that is, and how in many cultures that's also been honored, you know, or actually, you know, we honor you for giving your sons and all. So it's sort of, I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah.
And my favorite part was actually right after that, line 595, you know, which is talking about, you know, we're the prime of our lives, our husbands are gone, but it's just, well, what about the unmarried one who are slowly turning old age? And the magistrate says, well, don't men grow old too? And she goes, it's not the same thing, is it? A man comes home, he may be old and gray, but he can get himself a young wife in no time. But a woman's not in bloom for long, and if she isn't taken quickly, she won't be taken at all. And before long, she's left sitting at home, hoping to see some omen foretelling a happier future. And it's the same today. You know, men, or older men are always dating younger women, and the focus for women is you have to be young and sexy. And you have to be, and then if you're not a wife and mother, you've somehow failed in your life. And so I just thought that was very resonant, just that 2,500 years later, it's still true, sadly.
Yeah, that's
great. And then I was looking at, this is Andre, I'm just looking at a few lines down, maybe about 20, 30 lines, where in the course of old men brings up this metaphor of weaving again. And I'm sorry I don't have the line number, but it's down a little ways, and they say, this web they have woven round us, comrades, makes for tyranny. I have a different translation, I apologize. But they shall not tyrannize over me, for I will be on my guard, and I'll wreathe my manly blade in maiden hair. And there's some sort of a double entendre here with the murder of his carcass.
Hey, Andre, hold on just a second. Yeah. There's some noise in the background. I don't know if someone
chopping wood.
Chopping wood.
Somebody chopping wood. What?
It sounds
some
like
some of the brands they were going to burn the Acropolis with.
Perhaps they can put their phone on mute while they chop the wood.
Oh my God.
Good. All right. Excellent. Well,
so,
okay, go ahead, Andre.
I thought that was a really good quote, because it's talking about something, it's alluding to something that, you know, historically was significant to Athens, obviously, and then also this sexual double entendre, which is constantly, you know, popping up, pun intended. But anyway, then we have my favorite one was I don't have the exact line number here, but you all might recognize the part where the magistrate is talking about
hang on a second. It's still happening. I don't know if it's an artifact of, maybe there's something about the sound tonight when someone's speaking. Maybe it's creating a slight reverberation or something. If we don't talk,
yeah,
we won't hear it. So maybe a few more people can put their phones on mute. There may be, that might help, actually, just with the sound quality tonight. Okay, and I'm going to do the same for me until I'm talking again. Okay, so go ahead, Andre.
All right.
You start again. You were saying this, your favorite line and so on.
Well, this one's funny because it's about when the magistrate talks about crowbars. And he says something about, you know, how another goes to a cobbler, says, as a soldierly fellow, always standing up erect, and he says to him, cobbler, a sandal strap of my wife's pinches her, hurts her little toe in a place where she's sensitive. Come at noon and see if you can stretch out wider this thing that troubles her, loosen its tightness. And then it leads into the door metaphor and the crowbars and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, it's pretty funny. But I don't have your translation. Somebody wants to
take
it from there.
That's line 505.
Same with the.
Yeah, those are some really good lines there.
I thought, this is Frank. Again, same with the comedic part. I guess from round 4.
37 or so, when the magistrates are faced by try to come into the temple and they're stopped by the old ladies. So you lay a finger on her by pen, so hit you so hard you shit all over the place. What language? Tie this one up first. She won't hold her tongue. By the bringer of light, if you touch her, you'll soon be nursing a black eye. And it goes on and on. It just must be so jarring to the audience to have, you know, women, which obviously were portrayed by men, you know, fighting, you know, actually physically threatening, you know, government officials. Must have been a big laugh in the audience, and just, you know, so unexpected.
Yeah,
cool. All right, good. Let's hear from
that's right after the part that Andrea was talking about. Just kind of goes right into that.
Yeah. All right.
Hi, Steve.
Thank you.
Steven here.
Yep, Steven.
And I realized that when I talked to my lovely wife, Kendall, I read the wrong translation. I read the one that also has the clouds in it, and I thought that was the edition that I was supposed to read Liz Estrada in. So I did not read your version. But early on in the play, I have no line numbers, so that won't help. When Liz Estrada is trying to convince the women to give up sex, they're all saying, no, I would never do that, not in a million years, and blah, blah, blah. And I just think it's so funny that she ends up saying in this translation and adaptation, women, utter sluts, the entire sex, willpower, nil. We're perfect raw material for tragedy, the stuff of heroic lays, go to bed with a god and then get rid of the baby. That sums us up. And man, that's out there. And I would kind of fly in the face of our earlier viewer who was talking about Seinfeld. That's funny stuff. And to me, that very much points to the beginning of comedy, because if someone is able to make fun of themselves or their group in such a way to make a political point and hold the mirror up, as comedy has done since time immemorial, that's what we do best in comedy, I think, is allow people to see their foibles. And for a political play, which this is, which I guess we'll talk about later, it's remarkable to me that this guy wrote this thing. And I emphasize the word guy with intention. Anyway, that's kind of my favorite part, is when she's so sassy at the beginning, knowing her point of view and knowing how to try to elicit the same response in the other women.
Yeah. Okay, good. And that we're gonna get to the politics here in a moment. But good. Thank you, Stephen. Let's see. Alan or Zach, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, let me this is Alan. Let's shift into the politics, because my favorite passage, or one of the favorite passages, begins a little before line 650 on page, I guess, 166. And this comes after the what women have contributed and why they're can give good advice. But Stratilus really lays it out, I think, you know, politically, just sticks it to the men. In her song, I mean, it's it goes on, but it says, I'm a full member of your civic club. I give you men. That's how I pay my sub. And what do your lot pay? Where's all the gold your fathers took from the Persian fools of old? You squandered it and live instead on tax, and paying which you've something worse than lax. And, you know, basically says, you know, because of your decisions, we are now bankrupt.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Great. All right. Well, we're almost there. I just want to see if there's anyone else wants to share. We haven't heard Josh, Zach.
Okay.
Yeah, hi,
Cole.
Zach here.
Yep.
Okay.
There was the part where Liz Estrada comes to the realization that she needs to take action, and it's about line 520. And she's talking about all of the political blunders the men are committing one after another after another, and the women are just told to keep quiet when they criticize the political blunders of the men. And then it finally comes to a point, this is about 523, where even the men realize there's a problem, and Lysistrata says, but now every time two men meet in the street, what do they say? Isn't there a man in the country? And the answer comes, not one. That's why we women got together and decided to unite and save Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a ton of good stuff in there. And I had to say, my favorite part came right after I showed up. I read it when I was reading it the night before. I went in, I was consulting with a company here, and I set up the session, and everybody's wandering in. And the manager of the group goes, sorry, we're always late here. And I was taken right back to the first scene of the play the night before, and it's 2,500 years earlier. And the first joke in the play is about everybody being late for Lysistrata's meeting. And I'm like, exactly. Nothing's ever changed. We can talk all we want about how we want to run more efficient organizations, but it's just human to be late. And it's been funny for 2,500 years, so we might as well just accept it. That really got me started. And then the second thing that got me, and
just on that note, did you read the footnote on that for being late?
No, I missed it.
So the translator is implying that it was a political commentary on the Athens always being a little bit too late to rescue their allies in trouble.
Oh,
yeah.
They've been a political ally that as well.
It's true. I did catch that. You're right. Anyways, that was good. And then Lampido's accent immediately caught my attention. Like, Scottish accent? The Spartans with Scottish accents? Seriously? And then, so I said, well, what did the Spartans actually sound like? And so I went out and did a little research on the different pronunciations, and it really was quite different. So you had your example of Demeter earlier, or Demeter, as you said it, and the Spartans would have pronounced it Demeter, and the Attic people would have pronounced it Demeter. And so there really was a profound difference in how they spoke. So it's funny to see the translators putting that in there. And while I was reading it, the sort of the icing on the cake was, while British translators tend to give the Spartans Scottish accents, it's the American translators tend to give them Texan accents. You know, what does that say about the Spartans and what we thought of them?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And this version that I read that was wrong, they're all sounding like total hicks from up some hollow in eastern Kentucky.
Right.
And it's just so jarring. I guess Scott's accent is jarring too, especially if you're British. But I hear you.
I was going to ask, is that solely a translator's prerogative, or is there something in the original text that it was written in a different way, or with a different slang or a different dialect?
Well, what I read was that apparently the parts were pronounced differently. But there was, and that was because Spartans and Thebans and everybody else all had, you know, distinct accents. And when I went and looked at the different pronunciations, there really is some really wonky differences, because the Spartans all spoke the Doric dialect, while the Attic dialect had its own flavor, and the Ionic dialect was a third one. And then there were all these other variations for Boeotia and whatnot. The pronunciations. So, for instance,
did Aristophanes write it that way?
Pardon?
Did Aristophanes write it that way, or is it just the translators putting in, like we said, like a Kentucky hillbilly or a Texan or a Scottish? Did Aristophanes write it to make them sound less intelligent, or
just different?
Did he use their real dialect, or do we know?
Mr. Scott, I tried to figure that out. My Greek isn't nearly good enough, but I was just looking. And I mean, you can. It is generally the Spartans will get like one line, and then, you know, an Athenian will talk for a paragraph, and then a Spartan will say one more line. And they also they tend to use the the oath by the two gods. They just tend to use that one over and over and over again. So I think he was, I mean, I think a more sophisticated Greek reader could do a much better job of laying this out, but I suspect he did, it was really a text. And he really was trying to get across that they're, you know, they're first of all simpler and more direct, and that's not necessarily a, you know, a reflection of lack of intelligence, but they are, you know, probably supposed to come across as very much less sophisticated than the Athenians.
Now, listen, I, as a Texan, I don't know if I like being associated with a Kentucky hillbilly, okay? I mean, it's not the same thing, all right?
Well, so you don't mind this. What about the Scots? As a Scottish descendant, I'm not sure I think I like the idea that the Scots are hillbillies, but that's a whole different question. I don't think the text is different in terms of there weren't different words used or, you know, there wasn't a notes for pronunciation, but we can ask Paul Carlidge that and see if we can find out anything more.
That'd be great.
Cool. All right, so let's shift gears. So I think, you know, so here's what I want to do. I'd like to talk about as much as we can. So this was Aristophanes, a man writing for the theater in Athens. And by the way, there's a historic question mark about whether there were women in the audience. It's not known. Some scholars think there were women in the audience. Others think there were no women. It was only males in the audience as well. Of course, there were only men on stage. And we also know that Aristophanes was somewhat conservative, interestingly, and not a big fan of Athenian democracy, at least the way it was practiced in the years, many of the years that he was writing. So what's going on here? Let's have a conversation about what could Aristophanes be trying to do with as much context as we understand about that moment. And then let's have a conversation about what it means to us. Like I said earlier, who cares what he wanted? We can use this play however we want now, 2,500 years later. And it clearly can mean something very different to us today. But what do we think Aristophanes was trying to do here? Anyone want to?
Well, I'll jump in here because this is Zach. What one of the things that struck me about this play was compared to The Clouds, how, I hate to put it this way, but how not funny it was. The Clouds, I was amazed at how clever and funny it continually was, and this didn't strike me that way. And I think, to me, it's sort of an exercise in political despair. Athens was in an incredibly terrible political situation, and their political system was completely broken and incapable of dealing with the political situation they were in. And so as I read through this, to me, it was really a statement about how you know, it's political despair. I don't know how else to put it. It's like, what do you do? What actions do you take? What actions does a society take when their political system is broken and unable to address the problems the society has?
So there are two elements, at least, to what you're saying, Zach. But so let me. The first thing you said is that you didn't think it was funny. So I'd be interested to know if, at least not as compared to the first play we read last month, did other people think it wasn't funny, or are you, what do people think about that?
I think it's more of a satire than a comedy, and satire is a form of comedy, but it's not
right.
A laugh-out-loud comedy, and I just
right.
took it as The Clouds is more of a comedy, this is more of a satire.
Right, okay. Uh-huh, that's interesting. What about other people?
My wife complained that I was laughing out loud too much while I was reading it, but I have to say that there is something that has a certain, there's something about a continuous running of really bad sexual innuendo that just makes me laugh out loud. I don't know why, because he just never let up throughout the entire play.
Yeah. And there's especially that series of scenes where they're all walking around with erections, right?
Yeah.
and maybe, you know, it's like fart jokes or something, right? I don't know.
It's like the Three Stooges.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Even I have a feeling this play, like all plays, is meant to be seen and not read. And one of the reasons why Shakespeare can take
take off, I think, for people is when they put those words in their mouths and say them. And then it makes them do things that give the play life. And I think seeing this play done would be very funny. You just mentioned one of the most funny physical realities in it with all the guys walking around with phalluses. And I just think we must remember that. We must.
Yeah.
Or we're just not doing this play any favors by even looking at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think the concept is, it's just so funny. I mean, just the overarching idea that, if you mention it to somebody who's never heard of it, everybody chuckles, everybody does. So then what's done with it is, the question. I think, there are these humorous moments, but I think just the overarching theme of it is funny, particularly in the context where, I'm sure it would have been unusual for women to assert themselves in that way. Or maybe not. Maybe there were hidden ways that women did, and we just don't know about them that much.
All right, good. Well, let's address Zach's second point, which is that he felt this was a sort of exercise in political despair, that Athens, as you were saying, Zach, was in a terrible situation politically. What do people think about that? Or if you don't have a response to that, what would you like to add to the dialogue about what do you think Aristophanes was trying to do here?
Well, I think you're just trying to point out that, you always focusing on politics and violence and the big picture, sometimes you lose sight of what's important in your day-to-day life. And, while it's kind of bloody and, both the men and the women both, bemoan the fact that they wanted to live in a normal family life, if you will. I think we're kind of pointing out, don't neglect the last home. Don't neglect, the human relationships at the expense of international relationships. And maybe he was trying to do a conscious between the big world and the little world. And did it, by using the sex strike as a way to show the contrast.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting, Phil, that, given the situation of war between Sparta and Athens, this wasn't something that was in any way anti-Spartan. Both all the Greek city-states were represented relatively equally, in terms of their desire, both their silliness of wanting to fight war in terms of their men and their desire to get peace once this sex strike took place.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? And so, do you remember how many people, by the way, I think about at least half the people on the call read Thucydides. I'm thinking something like that, maybe a few more than half. Do you remember the Melian dialogue in Thucydides? Do you remember the...
Sure.
How, right? Do you want to briefly remind all of us what that was?
Oh, boy. I'm a little rusty. You correct my errors, but I mean, at the high level, it was essentially that they were trying to... they were allies of Sparta, and the Athenians wanted them to pledge allegiance to Athens, and basically given the choice of pledging allegiance or being slaughtered, and they chose to not pledge allegiance, and the Athenians slaughtered them all the men, enslaved the women and children that were left.
Yeah, you're in the ballpark. They voted to basically annihilate the colony. And then they had a vote again, and they're like, well, wait a minute, we have second thoughts about that, and they sent a second trireme out after the first one. And the reason I bring that up is, there were excesses, and you remember during the war when a general, for example, Thucydides himself, lost a battle, they were exiled, thrown out, fired, exiled, or sometimes worse, right? So they're clearly the Athenian and Aristophanes, I think one could argue, is saying with this play, at least from what I've read and understood as I've read the play, is that I think he was the friendliness to the Spartans that you were saying, Frank, about day-to-day life, he's trying to do something absurd with this play, absurd in the framework of the Athenian world, to say to his fellow men, because that's who he was primarily speaking to, this isn't working. And then, but it's also a comedy and he wants to win first prize. So it does need to be funny. I mean, Zach, I did think it was funny. I think maybe when performed, perhaps it's funnier than when read, or at least maybe when performed 2,500 years ago to that audience. But it's really, it's kind of hard to get your head around like what that world was at that time and what Aristophanes was doing here, because I think to a modern sensibility, at least to me as a modern person, to me it reads as a anti-war play of the first degree, and I think it was certainly seen that way in the United States in the 1960s, and can be seen that way today with the wars we've just come through. But I don't think Aristophanes was actually anti-war as much as he was anti the war they were continuously fighting and, was really destroying Athens in the process and emptying the treasury out in pointless ways.
But wait a minute. Isn't all war emptying the treasury out and killing off the young men? And I mean, when is war good? And of course, the study of history is the study of war and conflict. I get that. But I mean, why can't he be an anti-war play? Why can't this be looked at that way? I mean, of course it can be looked at that way. It has been. But
I'm not saying it can't be. I'm just saying.
That's not what I set out to do.
I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think so. But, and I don't have the truth here. And this point is debated. It's not completely understood. I mean, it's very hard to put ourselves in the heads of the ancient Athenians. And especially, I think it's even more difficult with the theatrical works than it is with some of the historical works that we've read. I know we've got about 15 or 20 minutes left. I was going to shift gears, but did someone want to?
Well, this is Bill. I was going to say, at parts when I was reading it, I almost thought the political and the stuff about politics and war seemed almost secondary to his commentary on not just on sex, but on gender, the role, the position and role of women. I mean, he seemed to take that as a fairly serious topic, because in some ways there's more commentary on that than on anything else in the play.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree.
Think, this is Andre, I think that if we look at back at, developments in America after World War I, after World War II, and how women took, filled in that gap when men were away, and then men come back from war, and then they try to, put everything back to where it was, where men are in charge again or whatever. I think that's a lot of there, because the old men are the ones that are defending, the men's cause, so to speak, because there's no, the young men are not around. And everything's turned upside down, Just like somebody said earlier, it was Aristophanes trying to put this absurd point out there to get people's attention. And one other thing that struck me was the fire in the water. When the women take the water and they put out the men's fire, there's an old custom that, when a man and woman got married, they would bring and share fire and water, and that would sort of start their new home. And when you see those sacred things in the household suddenly being abused or maligned or whatever, you've got some big problems. I mean, you've got some really crazy stuff going on in Athens, I think. So, and it's all happening in the home, This revolution is kind of coming from the household, not in the Senate House, something like that. So,
yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. Well, let's talk about how we want to read the play today, and what it meant to us as you know, modern readers. What'd you like? What'd you take away from it? Kendall, do you want to talk a little bit about Iceland? Are you there?
As soon as I unmute myself. there was a thing going around on Facebook yesterday as part of the International Women's Day commemoration about a strike that Icelandic women held in 1975 that I had never heard about. But, you know, women who worked outside the home, women who were homemakers, they all went on strike. And apparently, I've read a little bit about it today, they've done it several times. What's interesting is that Iceland is now thought to be the most gender equal culture and country on the planet.
Yeah.
So, I think and I don't know whether they were also withholding sex as part of that strike, but I think women come across in this play as being saner and more sensible than men.
Yeah.
I think the points that they make are, yes, it's bawdy and silly and funny and all of that, but there really aren't any wise men in this play, depicted in this play. You know, the only wisdom that I could see came from women.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah, and you said that he was a conservative, or there is some sort of history regarding Aristophanes as being conservative.
Yeah.
Of course, it's hard for us to look at this without the lens of, okay, if you're a feminist and you're a man, you're not conservative in 2015. But who knows what happened 2,500 years ago. I can't read this play. I can't imagine this play without thinking of it as an anti-war play, because the war is in the home. You mentioned this is all inside the home. It's inside the home because the young men are gone. As someone said, the women are being stronger and more sensible, as my lovely wife said, who's on another phone in the house. To read it today, this is a gender play about stupid men doing stupid things called war, which we as humans somehow created and have made the way we do things in terms of drawing borders, boundaries, etc. And I'll stop. But to me, I cannot look at it without considering those two prime issues. Just can't. Not in 2015.
Yeah.
My feeling was, knowing like whether or not there were women in the audience, to me it was almost like a woman's lib play to me.
Mm-hmm.
There's line page 60 where she's saying, "Well, we're taking control of the money there," and he's like, "You in charge of the money?" And she's like, "Well, what's so strange about that? You know, we've always been in charge of our housekeeping finances." He goes, "Well, it's not the same thing." She's like, "Why not?" And then on the next page, she's like, "Always till now, we've controlled our feelings and uncomplainingly endured whatever you men did. And in any case, you wouldn't let us say a word, but don't think we approved. We knew everything you were up to." So it's like, just because it's like, we know what's going on, we're
right.
Smart. Just because you don't want us to be doesn't make it so.
Right. Nan, did you read the footnote on that piece about, it was really quite interesting, but the word economics comes to us from Greek, and it actually comes from the word for household. Economics literally meant the household. So I think that's such an interesting history to that word embedded in what you're saying right now.
Yeah. So the phrase home economics is redundant?
It turns out it is.
Exactly.
That's exactly what I thought when I read that footnote. Like, yeah.
I think the other thing to note is that, and there's a wonderful speech toward the end about, you know, we're all Greeks and the Spartans should get along with the Athenians and all of that. But I mean, the fact that there is a Spartan woman as part of this, Lampito, and that, you know, the boundaries are drawn on gender lines, not on city-state lines. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think is an important point.
Yeah.
Men don't do that.
I'm going to take a cynical view here for a second and suggest that maybe the way this is being presented in terms of the strength of the women in this play is not as a women's lib exercise, but to make the men look worse by making the women look strong.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I one could wonder if we're spinning it more positively than we should, that Aristophanes may be saying, look how lame you men are, that the women are outclassing you, and you better watch out for these women because they're willing to betray, you know, your cause, meaning, you know, inviting a Spartan woman to join into this, you know, subvert your system of government and basically, you know, run you guys ragged. You better watch out. So it may not be intended as a feminist message. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know.
No, I completely agree with that. I don't think it was intended as a feminist message. I was answering the question, how do we read it now? How, you
yeah.
know, what do we get from
yeah.
it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Plus, like I
yeah.
said,
so,
too, depending
yeah.
on if women were in the audience or not, I fully agree with you. If it was a total man audience,
yeah.
total male audience, I agree, because that was my first reading of it. But then as you apply it to modern day, it's my second reading of it.
Right. Well, not only were women in the audience, but the people on stage were all men. So even the women were being acted out as men, too, which makes it less threatening to a male audience that's listening, because it's the men playing women.
Lampooning women, yeah.
I think, you know, one of the things that the Reading Odyssey experience has taught me, and I really treasure this lesson, is that it really, like, it's helpful to, I think, to separate these two things. What was the author's intention, and what does it mean to us as readers today? Because, it, you know, the author's intention doesn't really mean that much. The culture, and over time, culture can start to take something in a different direction, and what it means is what the culture, what it means to the culture and how we want to use it. The first time I saw this lesson really starkly was in when we read the Old Testament. And I'm not someone who had read the Old Testament before. And I was shocked by a lot of stuff in it, all that stuff you can imagine. But the thing that most profoundly affected me was the story of Exodus. So, you know, I grew up as a political activist. You know, Exodus, Bob Marley, you know, and Passover dinners and so on, is like, this is a great liberation story, right? And that is what it has meant for thousands of years, a liberation story. But what we read, we read an edition that seemed to be as close, it actually had several different translations embedded in it, if you remember Kendall and others who read it at the time. And what was really clear is that, do you remember this? Like, after the third plague, the Pharaoh, he was ready to let the Jews go. He was done. But God hardened his heart and basically pushed him to the Pharaoh, I mean, to continue to not let the Jews go. And what becomes very clear is that it seems to have been, at least in closer to the original, a story not about liberation, but about the glorification of God, and that God is all powerful. That, you know, if Pharaoh had let him go after the third plague, it was too easy. Like, you know, Pharaoh would not have learned his lesson that there was only one God, and his gods meant nothing. And I remember, you know, and I've gone in, you know, and I've picked up different translations in different synagogues that I've gone into, and I've talked to some rabbinical scholars about this, because it was like, it was outrageous to me. I was like, what? You know, this is a liberation story. This, and So that, you know, so I think you could argue that something similar is happening here, that Aristophanes was, from the point of view of a modern today, a very conservative, backwards, male chauvinist pig, and that he was using this storyline to try to show men how absurd they were being, that so absurd that even women were more reasonable than they were. But that's not how we read it today. Today it reads, and it has a different meaning. And I don't think understanding what Aristophanes might have attempted takes away from that at all. It doesn't for me.
I really wonder if the men in the audience who saw this originally, and as we said, it might have been all men. Who knows? If they swallowed that, or took that warning, or if they revolted in some way. Do we know if this was like successful, received well? Probably we don't. And that begs that question, doesn't it?
It was.
Don't you have two plays that season, and the other one was also about women.
Right.
I can't remember. I'm trying to look up to see if he got an award for this one or not. But he was certainly writing a lot of women-themed plays at the time.
Yeah.
Just one quick thing to point out when we're talking, you know, putting our own political, you know, glasses on when we think about Aristophanes, he's described as a conservative, and I think that's probably basically right. But he was certainly an admirer of Sparta, and I think any scientist, any student of the period would say that women had it better in Sparta than they had it in Athens.
Right.
So it may have been, to be sort of like pro-woman, he might have thought it was just consistent with his general conservative outlook.
Yeah, and I would guess that you know, it is true. I mean, although I think the point that people have made about, you know, what it means to us is not necessarily have to be what it meant at the time. But nonetheless, if we think about it and you know, what Aristophanes was trying to do, I mean, it's sort of a cliche to say multi-layered meaning and all the rest, but you know, in a sense, it may not only have one point, right? So as much as I think in some ways he was trying to compare the men of Athens and frankly of Greece unfavorably by showing how much smarter the women were, that still doesn't mean he didn't have some sensitivity to the unsort of appreciated virtues and wisdom of women, right? I mean, I think that comes through. I mean, he certainly is much more contemptuous of the men in the play than the women.
Yeah.
And I think he had to have some core appreciation for women who were not well appreciated in his society. And he probably understood it that way, that he was making a case for women that not all Athenian men may have been willing to accept.
Yeah, and probably not even Spartan men. I think that the women were the unrepresented segment of society. They had to bear the burden of all the war, whether they won or lost, and Athens did lose eventually. But, you know, whether you're Spartan or an Athenian woman, you don't get to really have a say about it, but you have to suffer the full, you know, brunt of it when your husband and your son don't come home. And there's nothing left at the end of it all. I don't think Sparta came out of it much better than Athens. And I don't see many other plays except The Trojan Woman by Euripides that really try to, you know, show the other side of this war.
Yeah. There's also some discussion about what effect this had on Plato and writing of the Republic, where he calls for the radical equality of women in a serious way, as far as I can tell, the first serious call for complete and total equality in written history. I'll also note that in 1946, Lysistrata was performed in New York with an all-black cast. With after World War II, you know, when many African Americans had served in the armed forces but had to return to a completely segregated country and still a pretty much segregated army. There had been some things that had changed, but you know, it was still pretty tough. I thought that was interesting. I think it's, you know, it's, this play has meant a lot to a lot of different people over time. And I think, you know, it's important to honor that and respect that.
But when you think about this play being presented in probably modern times up until very recently, and you read the play, think about how much of it must have been expurgated from any modern performance.
Yes.
I mean, even today, you would probably not see all of the humor be included.
Right. Yes, that's true.
You know, I was looking up.
Say that again.
No, it's Cole here. There's something that's really sort of stood out as being an oddity with this one, too. It's the women aren't anti-war. They're anti-war with Sparta and other Greeks. And that's sort of an interesting message
that's
for
right.
us, I think, in today's society. I mean, just much like the mothers send their children off to war, if you're going to send our, you know, if we're going to send our sons and daughters off to die, we should be sending them off for the right reason. And, you know, that's something that in today's society we continue to grapple with. Are we fighting the right wars? Were there, you know, have all these recent wars really been the right wars for us to be spending our lifeblood on as nations? Right, none of our economies have done well out of the last few years. This is, and it's the same question that I think is being asked in Liza Strata. There, you know, this ongoing war among the Greeks has emptied the coffers and depleted the economies of these once great nations that were allies. And here we are again today, frittering away our wealth and money on wars that aren't bringing anything home.
Right, and there's a debate just within the Republican Party on this very point, by the way. There is quite a strong strand within the party that is unhappy with the foreign policy and the expense, you know, and there's a fight about that. But in 2001, there was an Israeli playwright, Anatol Gov, who created a play called Lysistrata 2000, which had anti-war messages relative to Israel at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2003, there was a peace protest called the Lysistrata Project based on the readings of the play worldwide, put together by a group that was responding to the Iraq war, Iraq disarmament crisis is what they call it, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was just before the war and the question of whether there were weapons of mass destruction. Yeah.
It was.
So it's interesting. I mean, this play has meant a lot to a lot of different people. I think, you know, it can be used it clearly has a lot of resonance. And it's interesting. It's still being very much discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Much more than most of the ancient Greek plays. Perhaps most of all, I don't know.
How many survive, right? This one's stuck around for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, but even we have, you know, we've read several others by Aristophanes. I think 11 or so, maybe 13 of his survived.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about next month. Let's see. Let's just discuss what we're reading and the translation we're reading, that's all clear to everyone. Of course, if you don't have that translation, that's okay. Let's see. We're going to read Frogs, and we're recommending Richmond Lattimore's. Is it Richmond Lattimore?
Oh,
it was Richard.
Yeah.
I thought it was Richard.
Yeah. It's Richmond.
Richmond. Okay.
Oh,
yeah, I've been misreading that for years. Okay.
Exactly.
It's a great example of the mind thinking, seeing what it wants to see. Lattimore's translation, and we have a link to it if you want to get it. You know, I have read the last two plays on the Kindle, and I have to say it's made the conversations on the phone harder. I'm going to go back to paper because it's when people are sharing their favorite passages, it's just really hard to get to the passage on the Kindle that people are reading from. So, you know, I recommend paper if you can get it.
I think that one's available on Kindle anyway.
Is that that's only paper? Okay, good.
I think it's only paper.
I agree with you 100% still.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I thought I'd switch to the. I mean, I was on the road. I just got off the road. 5 week road trip, by the way, longest road trip I've ever had. But I, you know, not badly timed. Spent the last 5 weeks on the West Coast. Left New York February 3rd and got back this weekend.
I hate you.
Timing is everything.
Andre's like, what's the big deal? You know, I'm in Texas, just no problem.
Well, if you're in Dallas, you'd have some problems.
Yeah. And Zach, where are you? Are you in Texas too? I forget.
No, I live in Connecticut, but I'm in Florida right now for the month.
Oh, there you go. Smart man. Okay, so that's Monday, April 13th. So it's just a little more than a month from now. We'll talk about frogs, and that's from 405 BC. So this Lysistrata was from 411, and we'll try to wrap it up, and then we'll have a discussion with Paul and Bob on the 11th of May. So I see that many of you did sign up tonight. I appreciate that. I'm going to ask you one more favor for the May 11th, which is can you each commit to inviting or getting at least one person you know to join us for that call as well? That would be a big help. Bill Swizzle has been putting a lot of work into this. I just want to point that out. He's written something like 300 universities around the United States, Canada, and maybe England too, I forget, and trying to get them to spread the word among students and, you know, and their wider community of alumni and so forth. And so it's been great. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, one of the most valuable things we can do is to ask each of you to, you know, get at least one friend to join us for that phone conversation with Bob Mankoff and Paul Cartledge. They met recently in Cambridge. Bob flew over. They spent some time together. They're really taking this seriously, and want to create a good conversation. And I've been reading some stuff so I can hopefully moderate the thing well. But would love your help getting some more of an audience out. Yeah.
Great.
Cool. Okay. All right. Well, thank you all for another great conversation.
Thanks,
tonight.
Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
Yeah.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, look forward to it.
Setting this up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, thank you. All right, good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
The organizer has